Mara, and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, of course. Good morning to you, lurking conservatives, causing nothing but trouble. How is everybody? Hope everyone's okay. It's Thursday morning. I'm feeling all right. This humidity is killing me, man. It's killing me. The weight of it, Riley. I sleep with it. Even with the air on, the humidity is draining me, my friend.
Is draining. It draining you?
Dude, it's draining me. Last night, I just sat there without the air on with my cats. We were all just looking at each other like, well, who's going to turn the air on? Someone going to turn the air on? And they're all sprawled down. I'm like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to turn the air on. And I don't even know why I'm not turning the air on, because I got this idea in my head that I want cross ventilation. I want air coming through the apartment. But, you know, when it's this humid, who cares? I got one melon rind in the garbage can in the kitchen. The entire place smelled like rotten melon this morning.
Uh-oh.
And sardines. The guys over at Marino and Sons took care of me. I decided I wanted to...
Would they give you a crate load full of sardines?
You ever had fresh sardines?
Yes.
I'm a weird guy like that. You know, some people would shy away from that. But I went to a fancy Italian place with my wife when she was in town and got an appetizer of pan-fried sardines. And they were good, and they were too expensive. So with a certain amount of spite and contempt for the amount of money I paid for fried sardines out there in the world, I went and got my own from the fellows over at Marino and Sons, and I fried them up myself with a little flour. Excellent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's not big news.
Olive oil?
I tried it with olive oil the day before last, you know, but it was too heavy, so I went with a little canola oil.
A little
canola oil. So look at this, man. They pulled it off. Astronaut Stephen Robinson pulled two potentially dangerous pieces of gap filler from between the tile of the shuttle's underbelly yesterday with absolutely no problem at all. It was almost a letdown at how easy it was, but he didn't have to use his little jerry-rigged hacksaw, and the repair lasted about 6 hours, but most of that was him just sort of like, woo-hoo!
Floating around. Did you see him actually do it? It looked like there was some kind of red paint or something on the tile he pulled off.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no way to judge color. It seemed like everything was high resolution.
It was freaky space footage.
NASA felt that the exposed filler could possibly lead to another disaster on reentry, which they're saying that a little more specifically now. Well, now that it's gone, thank God, because that thing could have blown, man.
They say that the astronauts actually on the shuttle have noticed noticeably more relaxed. They're not as tense as they were.
I would be too.
I told you earlier in the week there was going to be a problem.
Apparently he got back in there to the shuttle, and Robinson said to James Kelly, the guy who operated the robotic arm that dangled Robinson in space, he said, quote, "That was the ride of the century. Very nice job," end quote. And now apparently they might have to go out there again. He might have to go out there again, but I would imagine at this point he's like, yeah, I want to go, man. I'm jonesing. Get me out into space. That was great.
That's the sequel to the movie they're going to make about his life after he gets back.
I hope so. You know, I think it was a pretty amazing thing. Apparently, there's something wrong with the blanket. There's a blanket on the outside of the nose of the plane. Mission Control told the astronauts that there was a remote possibility that this blanket might require a fourth spacewalk, because there's some concern about it. I'm not sure exactly. It's right beneath the commander's cockpit window, and it might come off during reentry and smack into the shuttle, because it's damaged from what they think is debris during liftoff. And I keep getting this image that they're worried that it'll cover the windshield. You know, when you're driving, like it'll flap up on the windshield, like, I can't see. Where's the runway? What are we gonna do?
You know, I just wonder, Mark. You know, if you had a car, and you know, you were driving it on the highway or something, and you know, like a door handle flew off, or you know, another piece of, you know, the hubcap flew off, or whatever. You do that. That happens a certain number of times. Sooner or later, you're gonna wonder whether the thing is made right. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And it seems to me with the shuttle, there's always something. There's a report that they knew about the phone problem, which we talked about earlier in the week. That they knew about it back in December. Somebody had written a report on it. What? How do you have stuff flying off a piece of material? A spacecraft that is this sophisticated. How does that happen?
Well, I guess I imagine it's like anything else. You got trial and error. It's just unfortunate when there are human people involved in the trial and error, but this is the way it goes. I mean, these are the sacrifices people make for progress. I mean, it's the way it always is. Apparently, a lot of people, though it's not an all-time low, it is low. I guess it is an all-time low. People polled still think the shuttle program is worth continuing, but that's down from 75% in 2003 to 59% as of yesterday. But people are still involved. They're encouraged. I think it freaks people out to see things, you know, flying in from space and blowing up. But I do believe that it's inevitable that this type of research has to be done. That's how I feel about it. So I vote that they continue it.
I do, too. I mean, look, I'm part of that generation that saw Alan Shepard go up in space in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the space program was new, and it represented the best of America. You know, there, sure. there was a whole feeling about yeah. it back then. It's kind of morphed into something very different now. I think people are a lot more used to it. But I think it needs to be upgraded, man. This, the spacecraft themselves are from, what, 1981 or 85 or somewhere in that general early 80s period. They haven't changed the technology in 20 years yep. on certain parts of it. They need to start again. They need to build safer, better craft.
Maybe a hybrid space shuttle, a
fuel-efficient space shuttle. Maybe they don't need as many tiles on it to keep the heat off during re-entry.
All I know is Richard Branson, Sir Richard Branson, is planning on Virgin flights into space in the very near future. I don't know how far into space he's planning on going, but that would be kind of interesting. Of course, you wouldn't be taking that ride, Riley.
I kind of like Virgin Air, actually, when I fly.
Oh, so you're saying if you get the little kid with the toothbrush
for my daughter and, you know, the nice video game on the maybe back of the seat, maybe I might make go.
All right, British police filed their first charges in the London terror investigation on Wednesday, accusing a 23-year-old man of withholding information about the July 21st transit bombers. He was charged under the anti-terrorism legislation and is to attend a hearing in London on Thursday. The charges could mark an important step forward for police seeking to build cases against the 17 people in custody in connection with the July 21st assault. Now, I say police like that because police are also trying to uncover the larger network that may have supported those attackers. Police pursued international links Wednesday to Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Zambia. And the reason I keep saying it like that, Riley, is this is a police investigation. This is not a military investigation. This is a law enforcement investigation. And this, according to most people, is the only effective way to actually make some progress in the war on terror, as they call it, in seeking out jihadist networks that are actually trying to kill people.
A law enforcement problem. I'm going to tell you something. I think they're going to make an example out of this guy in London, too. He's not being charged with being a bomber or with supplying materials or any of that. But he had information that he did not share about the July 21st attacks. And I think that the British in particular, in terms of the press I've been reading, are just kind of like fed up with this entire thing. And they're going to make an example out of this guy. They're going to put him away for a long time.
Well, I just think it's interesting that not only they're handling it within the country, but they're handling it publicly in the sense that, they have police investigators. This isn't somebody, sneaking out in the middle of the night, kidnapping people, bringing them to other countries to torture them, putting hundreds of citizens into prisons. I mean, the way they're doing this based on research, investigation, and good police work should be an example to the United States law enforcement community and the United States military that this stuff, through diligence and through investigation and not impatience and intimidation, some of this stuff can be solved.
Oh, absolutely. And the British are this new anti-terror legislation is going to have them at some point give the police and government officials the power to deport people who are considered radical Islamic clerics or people that advocate blowing up Britain or that sort of thing. It marks a sea change in the way the British have dealt with this issue.
Initially, the bombs that were thought to attack on July 7th, the big attack that killed 56 people, apparently an NYPD person who was over there with the investigation revealed some details about that attack. The bombs were thought to be military-made and smuggled in, but it turns out that they were MacGyvered. NYPD officials and investigators believe the bombers used hydrogen peroxide-based explosives called HMDT, hexamethylene triperoxide diamine. It can be made using hydrogen peroxide, citric acid, and heat tablets. Heat tablets are used in the military to cook stuff.
And citric acid, you can find in almost anything.
Yeah, well, it's vitamin C. It's orange juice. The bombs needed to be chilled because the compound degrades at room temperature, which explains the commercial-grade refrigerator they had at the flop house where these bombs were built. Now, the bombs apparently were transported in beer coolers, tucked in the back of two cars and parked on the outskirts of London. The three bombs that exploded were thought to be detonated by cell phones. Similar explosive compounds were used in the attacks of July 21st, except that the detonators were hand activated and they didn't go off. And maybe, Riley, they decomposed because they were heated. You know, apparently this is very it's volatile stuff in the sense that if it's not chilled, it won't blow up. So maybe that was working on behalf of the people on that on July 21st, that the detonators not only fizzled out, but maybe those bombs were not chilled enough to blow up.
Yeah, and you know, it appears as though they were able to, if these reports are to be believed, detonate the ones on the 7th by cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
So oh,
man. Let's get into Iraq. Let's get into the new title for the war. You know, during the campaign, you know, Bush had an idea of what the war should be called, and now there's a new idea for it. And now they don't seem to be quite on the same page on what name to call it. And I don't know if they're on the same page with anything. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Otasa katata matita. Hear my voice, idolaters, snucklers at the teats of beasts, and every guy named Ron in Hoboken. This is MILF Cardinal Milfington of Rapture Watch. And because I always want to know the latest on what Satan and his toad-licking minions are up to, I listen to the Morning Sedition, Monday through Friday, every hubdominal, look it up, from 6 to 9 a.m., here on Air America Radio.
How are you? 21 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
How are you?
Come on down to CBGB's. Help save CBGB's. The famed New York rock club is in danger of closing its doors, but we're going to be there tomorrow. You can go to CBGB.org to learn about how you can help save the club. We'll be broadcasting live from CBGB's in Manhattan tomorrow morning from 6 to 9. We've got little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos scheduled to appear. Comedian Jim Gaffigan. Live rock music. Free coffee. Giveaways. You can touch Mark Riley as
no,
usual.
No, you don't.
Pops Riley, as we call him out on the road.
God.
That's tomorrow morning at CBGB's at the corner of Bowery and Bleecker from 6 to 9. On Saturday, I will be in Seattle. I'm going to fly off and go to Seattle. I'll be at Giggles for two shows on Saturday night. That's GigglesComedyClub.com for ticket info on that. Let's get into this new language. You know, in the campaign trail, and by the way, we're going to be talking about mental health throughout the show, specifically about vets in just a few minutes in terms of, you know, vets coming home who have mental health problems, the repercussions of that and the type of treatment that they are or are not getting, that in a couple of minutes. But, Chris, I want to hear that segment from Bush on the campaign trail of him sort of, you know, bungling around trying to call, trying to name the war in his sort of improvisational way.
We've actually misnamed the war on terror. It ought to be the struggle against ideological extremists who do not believe in free societies, who happen to use terror as a weapon to try to shake the conscience of the free world. And
wow. But that is actually closer to what the military and Donald Rumsfeld have retitled this war. They're calling it the global struggle against violent extremism, but apparently no one checked with the president, or maybe they did. Maybe this is just another example of how the Republicans, the neocon death cult, put out mixed messages so they can do whatever they want. If there's no barometer for integrity or reality within the language of the administration, whoever is right gets the credit. Whoever is wrong disappears for a few months.
You know, this is he said he was a war president, and, you know, they had the Defense Department and Stephen Hadley and the rest of these people kind of soft-pedaling the whole war on terror frame, as it were. But now Bush, because I think it casts him in a role that he really enjoys, I think it casts him in the role of the warrior president, the guy who's still got a job to do, the guy who's still got work. I think that is, you know, why he's recasting this stuff, because that whole struggle against extremism makes him look lame duck.
Well, and also, yeah, this is what he bases personality on. I mean, there was a point during the campaign where he was trying to distance himself and get the war done, but now he wants the war war to go on forever. He wants to be seen as a warrior. He wants to I think you're right. I think he believes, he instinctively knows that the new title is complicated and it implies failure, and that people can smell that. And I think that the idea that well, basically what he said is that no one checked with me. That's a quote from the president. No one checked with me about the name change.
I don't know who leaked Valerie Plame's name.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could go down the hall. I could find out, but I don't know.
Could that possibly be true? Could he be that out of the loop that Donald Rumsfeld just you know, just runs roughshod over him and improvises and renames things, and that the head of the chiefs of staff, he goes ahead and he renames the war, and nobody
Myers?
Yeah, yeah, Myers, no, and no one goes, no one checks with the president. That's pretty profound stuff. And he quoted it in Texas. He says, make no mistake, we are still at war. This hinges, this is the new setup. I think the war on terror, the reason why he's hanging on to it is he knows that this is the new setup for the future, that this war is never ending, that it will keep going, and that that is necessary in order to maintain fear, control, big military contracts for military contractors that are in cahoots with this administration, and also that the American imperialist army can have a presence wherever necessary, whenever they want.
Well, see, what I think George W. Bush is doing here is becoming aggressive, going back on the offensive. And you have to take all of this stuff in context. The reframing of the war on terror back to the war on terror. The recess appointment of John Bolton. The reframing of the media to say that some of these congressional you know, things that have been passed have been victories for George W. Bush. He's trying to recast himself. And that's why you're going to hear in the weeks to come a lot more out of Bush about, you know, what little good news he thinks is coming out of Iraq. It's all part of the same frame.
Well, that's exactly. And there's also an issue as to, you know, like Larry Johnson says, this is the ex counterterrorism expert. He says, Larry Johnson has been on show many times. He basically states that there isn't still on, there's no one in charge of directing coordinated U.S. government policy to combat terrorism. Now, this war on terror, whatever he wants to call it, is there's still chaos. Like, you see some success in England with police work. But Larry Johnson, a guy who knows, says his battle over semantics, titles, language, reveal chaos at the core of the administration's lack of a plan to deal with actual terrorism. And also, there's this, you know, there's a conflict in message between the Pentagon saying we've got a pullout plan and Bush again saying we're not pulling out, not until we're done. And no one is saying whether that done means, you know, ending the insurgency. It remains unclear, but I think this is part of this tactic. It's a tactic on the behalf of this administration to send out mixed messages so no one really knows what the hell they're thinking, and it enables them a certain freedom.
No, I think Larry Johnson is absolutely right. Bush has no plan for Iraq, but Bush has a plan for Bush, and that's what we're seeing.
We've got the iNews coming up. I also want to talk about that battalion in Ohio that lost so many soldiers, and the mental health of soldiers returning back from Iraq. 27 past the hour, you're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Look, you know, we're going to be talking about the mental health of vets returning from Iraq and the fact that one in four homeless people in America is a veteran, and how are, and also how are those people treated? How are people with mental health you know, problems treated in this culture, this conservative culture that, that looks down upon the homeless, that looks down upon people that can't keep their act together by pulling their bootstraps up or just you know, bucking up? You know, let's talk about where that money is going and where it's not going in terms of mental health for people who are fighting for this administration, for this country. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying, my friend. So thank God for the iNews 5000. Let's feed it some headlines. Brendan P.W. McDonald, of course, will be doing that live tomorrow at CBGB's.
Yeah.
If you come down 6 to 9 in the morning, it's at Bleeker and Bowery. We got little Steven Van Zandt's going to be hanging out with us, and also comedian Jim Gaffigan, very funny guy. From the Sydney Morning Herald, UN gives Bolton a lukewarm welcome. UN gives Bolton a lukewarm welcome. Translation, China shop not happy to see bulls. There you go. How do you like that? From Times Online, Adidas buys Reebok for $3.8 billion. Adidas buys Reebok for $3.8 billion. A translation, minor glitch in Nike world domination plan. Well, I want to do that one again. Adidas buys Reebok for $3.8 million. A translation, Filipino sweatshop workers switch to exciting new logo.
Oh, by the way, that's billion.
Yeah, billion. Did I say million?
Yeah.
Billion. I'm sorry. Let me try the joke again now. Filipino sweatshop workers switch to exciting new logo. From MSNBC, new book answers why men have nipples. New book answers why men have nipples. Translation, male nipples, recharging point for alien spacecraft, book claims. A recharging port, that would be. All right. That'd be kind of weird, wouldn't it? Just like one day all these aliens come out of the sky and hook themselves up to our nipples. It'd be kind of cool, you know, weird. But, you know, it's from someone's imagination, that joke. Chris, why are you looking at me like that? Why are you looking, you know what I mean? Do you have sensitive nipples? Can I ask
yes,
you
I
that?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Riley, do you?
Yeah.
Oh, see, we're fortunate.
Yeah.
Me too. A lot of guys don't, you know.
Really?
It's very exciting to have them. And we should feel gifted that we have sensitive
nipples. Ooh. Who doesn't have sensitive nipples?
Look at McDonald's.
Yeah, we're going straight into the crapper now.
P.W. McDonald's like, no, it's like, I don't think he'd have a problem with the crapper, just this particular crapper. I think it's sort of surprised if it came out of nowhere. He's completely baffled as to why there are three men in the studio talking about
nipples.
Oh, God, I love these. Do I want to see your nipples?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, sure, why not? Since we don't have strippers on this program, I'll make do with yours, Chris. Come on. Oh, there's Brendan's. Nice. Oh, there's Dan's.
Oh, my. What is this, Jerry Springer?
Oh, you actually have them. Yeah, this is sad, whatever's just happened.
Now,
you know what I mean?
Brendan and Dan have very small nipples.
Oh, this is a slippery slope to having women strippers on here, and the whole show's going to change.
Lord.
All right, here we go. Let's talk about real stuff. In Brook Park, a suburb outside of Cleveland, residents piled red roses, American flags, notes, white crosses near the gates of the 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines, 19 of whom were killed in Iraq in the last few days. It's a tremendous, horrendous, horrible thing that's happened to that town, and also to, you know, to the military in general. The battalion's website has listed 25 dead this year. A reaction around this. There was a lot of grief, Riley, and from all the articles that I read, there was, you know, anger and frustration. But more than one of these residents did say, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, let's bring these guys home. This has gone on far enough.
Well, yeah, because they're starting to question exactly what the end game is. You know, you can talk semantics about the war on terror. You cannot talk semantics about 1,800 dead U.S. soldiers.
That's right, and it is over 1,800 now. And this is what is horrible. Not only are guys, you know, coming back dead, not only are there thousands of injured guys, but there is a lot of guys coming back with mental health problems. An Iraq War veteran carrying an assault rifle on his way to get a six-pack of beer.
Run.
You know, he killed a woman and injured a man in an alley in Las Vegas. Army Specialist Matthew Seppi, who is a 20-year-old guy, told police he was ambushed. He said he had been trained in the military that in an ambush, he should engage his targets and retreat. He killed a 47-year-old woman and injured a 26-year-old man. He's being held without bail on murder and attempted murder. Now, this guy was discharged in May, honorably discharged,
yeah,
at 20, which implies to me that something was going on. I mean, you don't get an honorable discharge at 20 unless he's got, you know, previous problems. And his mother said that, you know, he had been in contact with Veterans Affairs Administration for help with post-traumatic stress disorder since returning home. And apparently that there was no comment from the regional Veterans Affairs officials in Reno. And the police did find a 9mm pistol and 3 bullet casings in the alley. I don't know what happened there. But, you know, this is a guy walking to get beer with an assault rifle. Now, a couple things that stand out to me right away. Why didn't anyone stop him? You know, or say something, or call the police. You see a guy with a military-issue assault rifle walking down the street to the liquor store. I mean, are we at that point in this country where people are just like, dude, what's up?
Yeah.
You know, hey, nice gun. I mean, what the hell is that?
That's a very good question. But one thing is certain, this guy apparently, and I say that because the local veterans people, or the VA people, refused to comment, he probably got no help for that post-traumatic stress disorder that he was seeking help for.
Well, this is a real issue, is that, you know, the Veterans Administration is straining to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Between 96 and 2003, federal spending for the treatment of seriously mentally ill veterans decreased $630 million when adjusted for inflation. At the same time, the number of vets seeking those services is up around 11%. It climbed, you know, it's more than 11%. It's like 30%, but it climbed 11%. Yeah. 30% of U.S. troops who served in Iraq have developed stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home. Between January and September 2004, the number of Iraq vets seeking care with the VA increased by 280%. The number needing treatment for mental health issues has increased even more dramatically, and that is up 390%. All right, these numbers don't take into account the number of active duty troops suffering from mental issues while they're there. Meanwhile, the Bush administration shorted the Department of Veterans Affairs budget by $1 billion.
A billion, with a B. And, you know, when you start hearing statistics about 1 in 4 homeless Americans being a veteran, it brings to mind a story, a very quick story. At the old radio station, where this radio station used to be located on 2nd Avenue, there used to be a guy, a homeless guy, who would sit, like, right in front of the radio station most days. Really nice guy, wasn't an aggressive panhandler. One of the people that was on the air decided to find out exactly what was up with the guy, because he was there for, like, an extended period of time. It turned out, and this is something that is, he was not unique, it turned out the guy had been the recipient of, like, tens of thousands of dollars in veterans checks, but they had no idea where to send them. They were sitting somewhere.
Wow.
And they sat for, like, 2 or 3 years. The guy is begging for money in the street, and he had all of this money sitting up. So this guy, a guy by the name of Dr. Gerald Dees, really nice guy, actually navigated him through the system. And next time I saw him, he had, like, a Walkman on his head, and he had gotten an apartment because he had, like, 75-some-odd thousand dollars that he had never collected from the VA.
Wow, that's a surprise. That's a nice surprise to get. I don't know if guys that right now are getting the kind of treatment they need. And, you know, this is right at the core of the schism between right and left, is that, you know, the right, you know, in the chicken hawks and the people that send guys to war, expect them to do their duty, expect them to buck up, expect them to go out there and kill people at their behest. And when they come home compromised mentally or physically, they don't get the attention they need, and especially mentally handicapped people, there's a full range of symptoms. You know, it's anxiety, depression, nightmares, anger, inability to concentrate, shooting people in an alley with an assault weapon.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a full range of stuff that occurs when these guys don't get treatment because they don't prioritize mental health treatment. And these guys are the ones that fall off the grid. These are the ones that become homeless. These are the ones that have troubles at home forever. These are the ones that hurt people, and they're not getting the attention they need. If you're a vet and you have any sort of input around this and any way to share and tell us how you've been treated for your mental illness post-Iraq or post-Vietnam, or any vet, I'd like to know how you're being treated by the VA. It's 866-303-2270.
Or if you got family. I mean, sometimes it's people. It may not be you, but it may be somebody in your family. And, you know, Mark, when you hit on that whole idea of how the neocons disrespect service people, remember that the entire right-wing pundit establishment went after that guy Hackett out in Ohio. A veteran of the current war in Iraq, an Army Reserve major who apparently, and now that he lost the election, is talking about going back again.
And this is from the state where one battalion lost 19 people in the last 2 days, and they shamelessly put tons of money behind this guy, behind, you know,
they savaged him. They questioned his patriotism. Mm-hmm. They said that, you know, because he had the temerity to criticize the Bush war in Iraq, they went after him like red meat. And most of the people who went after him haven't spent a day in uniform.
And the woman that beat him barely was this woman, I think her name was Schmidt, who, you know, just used Republican talking points and Republican money to beat this guy up. And they slandered this guy. And this is a current vet, and that just goes to show you the attitude of this administration. 866-303-2270. I'd like to hear from vets' families, or anybody with information that we could use that's helpful in understanding a little bit more about how the neocon death cult disrespects our troops. deserves, certainly the ones that are mentally ill and homeless. 44 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Hey, it's 49 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We are talking about the way veterans are treated when they come back from Iraq, when they've come back from any conflict in this country's history. There's a 30% rate. 30% of the U.S. troops who served in Iraq have developed stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home. Those problems can go, you know, anywhere from anxiety, anger, depression, nightmares, inability to concentrate, and on the far end of the spectrum to, you know, shooting people in an alley with an assault rifle, as happened in Las Vegas, where an Iraq war veteran carrying an assault rifle on his way to get beer killed a woman and injured a man in an alley in Vegas. And this guy had contacted the Veterans Affairs Administration to help with post-traumatic stress disorder since returning home. Apparently, you know, whatever was going on, they weren't monitoring his situation or giving him the attention he needs. That would be apparent by the fact that he was walking down the street with an assault rifle.
Yes.
On his way to get beer.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my personal opinion. I wanted to clear up, we might have misstated it before when we were talking about Paul Hackett, the gentleman who ran for Congress in Ohio. He was a Marine reservist, but not an Army reservist. We are taking your calls at 866-303-2270 in relation to some of these things we're talking about. We'd like to hear from some vets who are returning from either the Gulf War, the Iraq War, any war, in terms of how you're being treated in relation to mental illness, to homelessness, because this is an administration and there is a Republican ideal that really condescends to the homeless, that really condescends to mental illness, that don't believe that these things are really sicknesses or a problem. They think that they should be handled by the individual and that the individual should be able to transcend them on their own. Let's take a call from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hyman, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Hyman.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Yeah. Listen, you're 100% on the mark.
Yeah?
Everything you're saying is absolutely correct.
And how do you know this, sir?
Because I'm a veteran myself, and I'm going through the system now to get benefits.
And what's going on with that?
It's a slow process, but you can't give up.
Yeah, and you are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, this is. And one of the points you made that was incredibly good was not just Vietnam, not just what's going on now, but back post-World War II.
Yeah.
Service in Germany post-World War II.
Sure.
And if you know where I'm going to go with this, some of the veterans that were in the service after World War II were exposed to some of these horrendous photographs of the things that occurred at that time. Do you know where I'm going with this? The memories that will come back to you?
No. I don't know where you're going with this.
Okay, well, the pictures, the people that survived.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Oh, the death camps? Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, after now, I'm going to be 75 next year.
Uh-huh.
These are the memories that come back. But let me go back to the point that you made. Any veteran from any service,
yeah.
Number one. Number two is the navigating through the system.
Yeah.
And it's very important, if you're a veteran, to try to go ahead and get some counsel and advice from some of the organizations that are out there. And some of them are incredibly good.
Oh, good. Yeah. Which ones?
For example, the DAV.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Disabled American Veterans.
Yeah, in other words, you've got to be able to just physically walk into the office and say to the guy, I would like to ask you for some help.
Hmm.
And they sit right down with you. They don't fool around. They sit right down with you. They get the paperwork out.
Mm-hmm.
They need your permission to act on your behalf.
Okay.
And they set the paperwork going.
Well, Hyman, thank you so much for...
Listen, you're on the mark. You're 100% on the mark. Briefly. People that have like hundreds of thousands of dollars in accounts that are set aside for them that they've never even been able to get at.
Yeah.
That's another thing that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a veteran in Boston here, for whatever this is worth. He had $300,000 in his account.
Wow.
And he was so mentally ill.
He could never access it.
He didn't know how to get at it.
Yeah.
Well, that's an important message for family members to hear.
And it's important that, you know, if there are people out there that know the system, because that's what happened in the case of the guy I was talking about. Somebody knew the system. Somebody helped him navigate the system, and eventually he got his money.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, that this was a multi-generational thing. This was a guy, this is a veteran from World War II.
From World War II. Sure.
And, you know, profoundly affected and had to deal with this for his whole life. But, you know, he had some positive things to say about Disabled American Veterans Association helping him. Herb, hold on. Let me just see what the. Here we go. Streaming in Mississippi. How are you?
Hey, Herb. I want to thank you guys for having this show, because what you were talking about has been a problem as long as I have been in the VA system, and I got out of the Air Force in 1976. I'm a Vietnam-era disabled service-connected veteran.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm talking about, I know.
Yeah.
And I got so, well, the VA actually killed me once.
Yeah.
I died from a simple procedure, but they were able to resuscitate me. And I went 18 months with a tear in my lining of my colon, and I was bleeding to death. I had bled so much that I actually had been told to make my final arrangements.
Oh, my. And this was because of a mistake at the VA?
Yes, for 18 months.
Wow.
And I have been in the mental hospital they had here in Gulfport, Mississippi, which the Bush administration has closed.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Vietnam-era veterans. I've seen all kinds of veterans there who were so far spaced out that they just didn't have any idea of where they were. You would see them running and hiding behind plants in the day room and yelling, take cover, take cover.
Right. Well, now, where do you go now for help, Herb?
I finally got sick of the VA system, and I found out that if I did things properly, because of my mental problem, I am a bipolar or manic depressive.
Yeah.
And that if I applied for Social Security, I could get on SSI.
Okay, well, that's helpful to people. Thanks a lot for calling, Herb.
Thanks for calling, Herb.
So, you know, it's interesting that people are finding other outlets through different different systems to get their help that they need, but it should be a little more clear. That was it's a very interesting range of calls we're getting. Jill in New Jersey, how are you, Jill?
Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
We only got a couple seconds. What's up?
Well, my father was a veteran from Vietnam. He's 100% disabled. And not only physically do they not really give him the health care at all, that he hasn't been feeling well in years. They don't give him any answers. But financially, he was getting paid a certain amount a month for years and years. And one day, about 10 years ago, they just sent him something saying, all this time we've been paying you too much, and now we need it back.
Oh, that's horrible.
After that, they just significantly reduced the amount that he got every month.
I'm sad. I'm sorry to hear that, Jill. We got to run. We got a break coming up. Thank you for sharing with us. So it's just unbelievable the stories that are coming in. We will be back. I guess we'll continue this conversation a little later. But thanks for your calls. It's a morning's edition on Air America Radio. We'll talk to you in a second. Six past the hour, it's Air America's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. We're all sugared up on donuts and coffee now.
Yeah, baby.
Man, that was a good idea. Go get two boxes of donuts. Good. Good
thanks,
news.
Thanks, Bashman. It's
perfect. Hey, folks, tomorrow we're going to be at CBGB's here in Manhattan, the legendary rock club. We're going to have little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos. He's going to come down. Comedian Jim Gaffigan will be there. Live rock, free coffee, giveaways. Mark and me,
That's right, but don't try and touch me, all right?
Oh, you can touch Pops. Riley doesn't mind. Rub his belly. It's good luck. That's the CBGB's tomorrow.
Send a picture first.
But yeah, there you go. Now we're going to get pictures.
Yeah.
Bowery and Bleeker from 6 to 9. Also, you know, CBGB's could use a little help. The New York Rock Club is in danger of closing its doors, and it is sort of a monument to the punk rock movement. So if you want, you can go to cbgb.org to learn how you can help. And, of course, join us there tomorrow. On Saturday, I will be at Giggles in Seattle. If you want to check into that, go to giggles comedy club.com. I'll be there for two shows. For those of you who are just tuning into our show, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's morning's edition, Cliff Notes. Some elected officials in New York are calling on police to target Arabs during security checks. Civil libertarians point out that racial profiling during subway checks is racist, and they say it won't work since most Arabs are driving cabs anyways. This matches the anti-terrorist measures taken after the Oklahoma City bombing, when police only bothered to search jug-eared white guys. President Bush allegedly objects to the war on terror being renamed the Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism, or GSAVE. Bush objects to the new acronym because he hates any language that's accurate and descriptive. A pioneering South Korean scientist has cloned the first dog. Scientists are hopeful that the new cloning technique will go a long way toward alleviating the worldwide shortage of dogs. One Korean scientist said the only drawback with the clone dog is they have a slight chemical taste. Oh, boy. This is a good one today, huh, Riley?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
All aboard.
We're giddy on donuts. Astronaut Stephen Robinson pulled two potentially dangerous pieces of gap filler from the tile of the shuttle's underbelly yesterday with no real problems. It went pretty quick. He didn't have to use the jerry-rigged hacksaw. The repair lasted 6 hours. A lot of that was just floating around in space. NASA felt that the exposed filler could lead to another disaster on reentry. The challenge was to perform an unprecedented in-flight repair, and the crew rose to the occasion. They might have to go out again to repair a sheet of material that is just under the cockpit window. NASA is going to decide on that. Upon returning to the shuttle, Robinson said to James Kelly, the astronaut who operated the robotic arm that dangled Robinson in space, he said, quote, "That was the ride of the century. Very nice job. When can I go back out, man?
Yeah.
I want to live in space." He got a taste of the space. He wants to go back out there. Though it's at an all-time low, people polled still think the shuttle program is worth continuing. It's down from 75% in 2003 to 59%, but still, most people polled think it's definitely worthwhile.
Does he get to keep the material, you think?
They all take a little something, I think.
Hey, man, that's money in the bank. You bring it back home. You put it on display.
Did you see the right stuff when Gus Grissom came back from the first flight and he lost the capsule?
Yeah.
And he's being interrogated almost by NASA and government officials. And he takes off his spacesuit, and he brought all these rolls of quarters and all this stuff because he'd been in space. He thought he was going to sell it.
Yeah.
Can you just lie about that? You got to try. Yeah, respect the guy's integrity that he wasn't just going to sell a quarter that was in space, but it wasn't.
Right.
All right. British police filed their first charges in London terror investigations Wednesday, accusing a 23-year-old man of withholding information about the July 21st transit bombs. That was the killer bombings that killed 56 people. He was charged under anti-terrorism legislation and is to attend a hearing in London on Thursday. This charge could mark an important step forward for police seeking to build cases against the 17 people in custody. Police are also trying to uncover the larger network that may have supported those attackers. Police pursued international links Wednesday to Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Zambia. Again, reiterating police, because this was a police investigation. This was done as a law enforcement investigation, and they're finding some success in that, and as opposed to a military operation, which is what is not providing as much success in terms of fighting or actually catching terrorists. You can't just do these sweeps and put a bunch of people in jail and just hold them there forever. They are actually doing the groundwork and investigating terror cells, and it seems to be working there.
Well, see, the broad implication here, Mark, mm-hmm. is that the police and law enforcement apparatus works better with intelligence in Britain than the equivalent relationship here in the States. In other words, the New York Police Department may not have the greatest relationship in the world with the CIA, which is the country's main intelligence gathering organization, but it appears as though Scotland Yard and MI6 have a better relationship in Britain, so they're able to work in concert, share information, and then start pursuing these links in different parts of the world.
There's no inter-bureau.
I got it first.
Right,
yeah.
Competition. There's a seemingly a fairly clear channel communications, which we don't have here, certainly between the CIA, the FBI, local police forces are all competing.
Yeah.
These are issues that should have been resolved. These were issues that were brought up by the 9/11 Commission. These are issues that really are really the core of what we need to do to really have a functioning protection against these terrorists, these jihadists that want to blow us up.
Well, and see, what we're starting to understand now is that cells like this, these small groups of people, whether they be from East Africa or from Pakistan, as is the case in Britain, they have equivalent cells, and people will admit this. They have equivalent cells here in the States. There are certain small groups of people, in some cases, I guess, second-generation immigrants, not new immigrants necessarily, and by the way, not all Arab.
Right.
That's important,
yeah, that
because
important.
Of the story we are going to discuss.
That's right. Well, before we discuss cells, terror cells, and anti-Arab sentiment here in the States, let's talk about stem cells, can we? scientists in Korea actually cloned a dog. They produced the first cloned dog. One of the puppies died after birth, but one lives. An Afghan hound named Snuppy is still alive after 16 weeks. Snuppy stands for Seoul National University Puppy. Scientists took genetic material from an ear cell and placed it into an empty egg cell. The egg was stimulated to start dividing into an embryo. Then it was transferred into Snuppy's surrogate mother and was born by C-section after 60 days of pregnancy. And that is important, Riley, because they can clone a lot of different animals, but they haven't been able to do it with a dog. And a dog is a tough clone. And apparently they got 3 pregnancies from more than 1,000 embryo transfers into 123 recipient dogs. Apparently the overall objective of the program is to learn about the root causes of disease. It's not to, you know, make dogs from people's dead pets so they don't ever have to let go of their pets. Some people are paying, you know, thousands of dollars for that. Scientists believe it is possible that you can responsibly develop the ability to derive stem cells from cloned dog embryos, that they could be the first beneficiaries of stem cell medicine. So this is all in the name of the big research that we can't do here as freely as we might want to.
Yeah, and see, one of the things that the South Koreans are starting to prove with all of this stem cell research is that they can, you know, technology can outpace religion and it can outpace the law. You can have religious problems with all of this stuff, with cloned dogs, cloned sheep, all of that. But the fact of the matter is, as scientists get to the point where they're able to do these things, they do these things.
Well, sure, they're good. They don't care. They don't need to make it public. If there's money funding the research, they'll do the research, and they'll just keep it keep it quiet until they, you know, can sell it for millions of dollars and actually help people.
Yeah, and there is plenty of money. It doesn't necessarily have to be government money, but there is plenty of money in the private sector that helps fund a lot of this research. It's done on the down low, but it is done.
I bet you has something to do with why Senator Bill Frist is now taking the stand that stem cell research is good, because his family's in hospitals.
Well, he's a campaign contributor.
Yeah, well, I bet you it's his own family. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to investigate that, because I was wondering about that weird switch of things, but I knew it was just for his own well-being, his own financial well-being, because his family's in hospitals.
Yeah, his family owns a chain of hospitals and doing
hospital.
Quite well.
Yep.
Yeah.
So speaking of stem cells, Sammy the Stem Cell is going to be with us momentarily. You might want to hang around for that. Yes,
can I go while he's here?
No,
can
no,
I leave?
No. We're going to take it. We're going to take it from Sammy the Stem Cell. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Just a few minutes, we're going to have the final installment of the Temple of Doom, the Morning Sedition radio theater thing. But right now, to help us sort out some of the latest developments and issues surrounding stem cell research, we have a very controversial guest, Sammy the Stem Cell. Welcome.
Hi. I'm sorry, a stem cell.
Now, Sammy, let's get right to it. Bill Frist's announcement last week that he'll support federal funding for stem cell research. You must be pretty steamed.
Now, why don't you go shave a cat, you soy gurgling recovery hippie?
So, you're upset?
On the contrary, Mark, I'm fine with it. You know, Scientology does not let you hate people.
Wait, you're a Scientologist now?
Yeah, what about it?
Hey, never mind. Nothing. So, Frist advocating tax dollars be spent on stem cell research doesn't upset you? I mean, that's quite a flip-flop, don't you think?
No, you know, everyone has a right to change their mind, Mark. Heck, even a level 3 knows about the importance of expressing your true feelings, no matter how diverse or contrary they may be to others. You got that, you stink-pitted sofa monkey?
Well, that's really surprising you're being so reasonable about this. Hey, wait a minute. Did you just call me a stink-pitted sofa monkey?
Ooh, wow, you're quick. You ever consider getting a toupee with some brains in it?
Hey, wait a minute.
Hey, you know, I used to have a shirt like that until my dad got a job.
Hey, what the?
Hey, I heard your mom made $1 million.
Uh-huh.
Picking up quarters with her vagina.
Oh, my God. You're disgusting.
Yeah.
You're disgusting.
My God, you're welcome.
So you have no reaction to Frist flip-flopping like that?
Sure I do. We're going to sue his ass. You know, I'm a level 8. They can't touch me. I'm sacred human life brought here by an alien life force 70 billion years ago. Tom Cruise said so. And speaking of flip-flops, I talked to your wife. She says you're like an overcooked plate of spaghetti.
Hey, come on, man.
Your noodle's so soft, you know
hey,
what I mean?
Well, come on. Oh, come on. Shut up, you vile parasite. I hope you're the first one they cut open.
Oh, yeah? Well, it still won't grow you a new act. Ow! 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 Stop eating me! Stop it! Ow!
Shut up. I'm not eating you. You're just pushing a sound effects button.
Oh, you're very clever, man.
Why don't you just leave?
Yeah, and why don't you just shut your pie hole?
All right, get out now.
Oh, wait. Mark, turn the music down, will you? Mark?
Yeah.
Please wait. I'm sorry. Just give me one more chance. I know I can make it up to you.
Oh, my God, you're putting some kind of goo all over the console. What the hell is that?
Yeah, eat cytoplasm, chump. I've got sacred human life goo.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's just, get out of here, you a-hole.
No problem, nuts. You and the horse you rode in on. I don't want to be Hitler anymore. I want to grow up to be L. Ron Hubbard.
Well, good luck. Get out of here. God, I hate you.
I'm a level 8. You can't touch a level 8.
Get out.
Ow!
Get it.
Ow!
You freak. I'm tired of it. Leave. Man, that guy's creepy.
Yeah, he sure is.
Yeah. It's good. Hey, you know what? In a second, this has been something that I've talked about a lot, which is, I talk about it on stage a lot, too, which is the idea that everybody needs medication. See, everybody you talk to, everyone I know, Jim Earl, are you on medication?
Yes, I am.
Are you?
Self-medication.
Yeah.
What kind of medicine are you on?
You know, I'm self-medicating with Ritalin.
Getting street Ritalin?
Yeah. Street Rid.
There's very few people I know that aren't on medication. It's my belief that not everybody is depressed, that happiness is a tall order. Happiness was not supposed to mean a sort of constant state. It was supposed to be something you can enjoy every few minutes. Who the hell knows? How long does happiness really last? 5-6 minutes right after you, and then when you realize it's happening, you're like, oh my God, I just had it, and then you ruined it by talking to me. My point is, Jim,
if you get to level 13, you don't need any kind of...
Do you know a lot about Scientology?
Oh, man. I was in it for 5 years.
No, you were not.
I'm still in it.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I am.
No, you're not.
You lie like a rug.
L. Ron Hubbard is my...
They call him L. Ron. Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
See, I don't want to be confused with a Scientologist because I am. I don't believe that depression in a lot of cases is really depression. But here's what I'm getting at. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to a guy. He is the co-author of this book, Selling Sickness: How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All into Patients. And he's going to talk about the way pharmaceutical companies at some point basically said, look, why can't we sell medicine to people even when they're not sick? Why can't we make medicine like chewing gum? Everybody needs pills. All we got to do is convince them that they're sick. And this is just healthy people who think that medicine can make their lives better and they're not necessarily sick. And how often is that happening?
It depends on all of these new diseases and all these new illnesses that people have. It must be happening a lot because we've gotten a whole bunch of them in the last 20 years.
That's it. What's the credibility of the diagnosis of those diseases, of the pathology of those diseases? Could they be fictional? Could they be made up? Could they be? I mean, I see posters for social anxiety disorder. I'm like, wait, you mean shyness?
Shyness, yeah.
Shouldn't someone just go talk to somebody? And if you look at the symptoms of psychological illnesses, you can have like four or five of them. I mean, just because some of them are just kind of, you know, do you hate your job? Oh, I do. I need pills.
Is that how it goes?
What's on your mind,
Jim? I have
an
example of this. You know that drug Lamisil?
Yes, it's an antifungal, isn't it?
Yeah. Take that, it goes inside your body. Yeah. From inside out, it's supposed to kill a fungus, right?
I've done that.
Yeah. You know what? You know what works just as well?
What?
For the same amount of time you're supposed to use it?
What? Steroids.
Put white vinegar on the toenail 2 times a day for 6 months. The same dosage and same time amount.
Wow, who's
of Lamisil.
Who's a hippie now?
Yeah, really.
No, this is true. But you don't
need to do a systemic medication for a fungal.
You don't hurt your liver.
Yeah, well, I've done that because I have. Can I be candid? I have a little tinea occasionally, and I've taken the Lamisil. And you're right, it gives me the creeps because it is a systemic. But this is not essentially the problem, but it's part of it because you're right. There are plenty
unnecessary medication.
Right, there are plenty of holistic health aids that can actually help that aren't just this crazy. You know, like some things of like echinacea apparently is
hey,
not.
Matt,
yes.
What do you have?
Tinea.
What is that?
He's got a very tinea.
What is tinea? It's just a tinea is like it's like athlete's foot. It's like it's a temporary discoloring of the skin.
Why are you rubbing your arm?
It's not on now.
Oh.
It can be anywhere. It's just a fungal thing. It comes from sweat. You know,
ask Dr. Bronner over here.
I thought
he'll
I got
take
it.
So it's athlete's foot for your entire body.
Yeah, it can be anywhere. But athlete's foot sometimes is a type of fungus. What are you getting at? I think I got it at camp. Yeah. I got it at camp when I was younger. Yeah, I don't know. I was sleeping with a fungus.
Fungus always grosses
don't
people
call
out.
Her that.
No, she was there. All right, so we're going to be back with Ray Monahan. He's the co-author of Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Man, we're just recovering for a Google search on tinea in images for Chris. You don't realize medical photographs is always going to be the worst. I'm sorry, buddy. I didn't ask you to do that. You decided to do your own little research here.
Don't do it.
I'm
please.
Not. All right, all right.
Listeners, do not.
Every time you turn on the TV, you're barraged for ads trying to convince you you're sick. Whether it's shyness, sadness, distractibility, or poor performance in the bedroom, if you believe the ads, you're probably sick with something. But since when has being shy at parties meant that you were suffering from some grave illness? Our next guest is going to tell us. He is the co-author with Alan Cassells of Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. Raymond Moynihan is with us on the phone this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mark and Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks for being on the show. So I find your book very compelling because I think this is a crime, and I think that over-medicating of the population is leading to horrendous things. How does the pharmaceutical industry target the healthy exactly?
Look, there's many marketing strategies, many of which your listeners will already seen. You see this direct-to-consumer advertising bombarding everyone. I think Americans watch something like 10 drug ads per day on average.
Yeah.
But there's lots of subterranean marketing strategies, and that's what the book's about. It's about the way drug companies use celebrities, about the way they use patient groups, about the way they work with so-called key opinion leaders within the medical profession.
Well, I remember when Prozac got popular, it became a cultural phenomenon.
It was. But now we've not just had Prozac, we've had, Viagra, we have Paxil, we've now had, the whole Vioxx and Celebrex thing too. But But what I'm interested is not just how the drugs are marketed, but how the very disorders, the diseases, the dysfunctions, how they are marketed as well.
Some of them are not even real dysfunctions, right?
Well, there's one called PMDD, mm-hmm. premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and there's a real debate within the medical community about whether this is a real disease or not. And so you've got some, you know, psychiatrists who sort of side with industry, saying yes, this is a genuine psychiatric disorder, and you've got other people saying no, this is just what women, you know, what we've called PMS for centuries, and this is just what women suffer, you know, at the beginning of their period.
Uh-huh. Now, what I want to know is, I've talked to a lot of people, and it seems to me that psychiatrists, more so than not, before having any sort of consultation or even therapy sessions, are putting people on psychopharmaceutical medication almost immediately, because I imagine that these drug companies have turned out, you know, not unlike a pimp turns out hookers, a lot of psychiatrists in terms of pushing this medication that has no real bearing on the illness.
Look, let's say at the outset that a lot of these drugs are valuable. They save life. They reduce suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But let's also say that psychiatry, like many of the specialties within medicine, is simply being bought off by Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
There is no question. All of the conferences, all of, you know, much of the medical education, you know, whenever a senior physician moves in this country, a drug company, you know, is often paying the bills, and that's part of the problem here. And so this entanglement between doctors and drug companies is part of this story, and you know, it really needs to be cleaned up.
Ray Moynihan, it seems to me that if you look at how Americans are sold things in general, for example, 20 years ago, most Americans had a land telephone line in their homes. Now we got cell phones, we got fax lines, we got all these different things. Same people, just a whole lot more stuff that costs a whole lot more money. Isn't what you're talking about here with these drugs a variation on that same business model?
I think you're absolutely right, Mark. I mean, I think it's just about trying to sell us more and more stuff. And, you know, ultimately this is about trying to sell us drugs. But what, you know, I want to argue is that all these marketing strategies are changing the way we think about our bodies. They're designed to make us think that the normal ups and downs of life are some symptoms of some medical condition. And, you know, I just think that the amount of this advertising, the magnitude of this marketing is really out of control. And some kind of public debate about the marketing of illness, the selling of sickness, is well overdue.
You know, Ray, I personally hate pills. But the one thing that I realize when you watch a lot of drug commercials is the side effects include part of the commercial, which is usually at the very end and, you know, spoken sure. very quickly. That's not a disincentive to use some of this? I mean, some of the things I see for drugs, the side effects seem worse than the illness that the drug's supposed to cure.
Sometimes that's correct.
What's a little diarrhea if you're going to be happy all the time?
It's sometimes, you know, the side effects are horrendous. Sometimes if you're genuinely ill, of course the side effects are worth the risk because the benefits will outweigh them. But I think, you know, whatever the fear about side effects, the facts are that the annual number of prescriptions in the US just keep going up and up. And while you make up maybe less than 5% of the world's population, you account for about 50% of the global drug spend, the global drug budget every year.
Well, they've sold us on this idea that happiness is a desired state all the time. I have always said that, you know, most people who are on medication for depression aren't really depressed. They're just experiencing, as you say, the ups and downs of life. And I believe that the only difference between, you know, disappointment and depression is your level of commitment sometimes.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, we've got to be careful. I mean, who's to judge who should get a medicine and who shouldn't? That sort of decision has to be made by the individual with their health professional, with their family, with their friends, with their loved ones. But you know, what we really need is more rigorous studies of who's being medicated, who doesn't need it, and who's missing out. And there's strong evidence, you know, in the mental health area that many severely ill people are missing out on the treatment that they should get. And so that's a real problem. And I argue that if we weren't wasting so many resources trying to tell people with mild problems that they're sick, we'd have a lot more resources to treat and prevent genuine illness.
But also about resources also to examine just, you know, how this over-medication of society and changing their mental patterns and their mental brain chemistry is affecting them and the culture as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. We still don't know what all that direct-to-consumer advertising is doing to us.
Yeah.
Because we haven't had any big, rigorous studies. We simply haven't. The drug industry knows that it's working. The drug industry knows those ads are pushing up sales, and so they keep throwing more money at it. But we actually don't know what impacts it's having. We don't know how many people are being over-medicated, how many people are unnecessarily starting to see their lives, see their sexual difficulties as sexual dysfunctions.
Right. Why does this appear to be? Because the implication, I think, that you're giving our listeners is that this is a U.S. phenomenon. Is that due largely to this direct-to-consumer advertising, or are there other factors that make the U.S. unique in this regard?
The U.S. is pretty unique in the world, isn't it? Let's face it.
Yes, we're Americans, damn it.
But look, it's the epicenter of a global phenomenon, if I can say that without sounding too much like a, you know, a geek. This is, you know, the global marketing strategies of the big drug companies emanate from that island where I think you guys are pretty close to, Manhattan.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're on it.
Okay, well, there you are. So, But the marketing strategies hatched out in the PR houses, you know, in your neighborhood,
yeah,
wash throughout the world. And so we see marketing campaigns in Australia, in Europe, in New Zealand, wash around the world. The difference is in most countries you can't advertise drugs directly, but you can advertise diseases. And so even in Australia, for example, we see these so-called disease awareness campaigns.
Interesting.
That are funded by companies and are essentially made to make us fearful in order to sell us drugs.
Well, that's interesting. So your book draws a direct connection to the power of the freedom to advertise drugs and the consumption of drugs in this country. That's interesting. I appreciate you being with us, because this stuff is very it's very exciting to talk about to me. I wish you great luck with the book. It's Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. Ray Moynihan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you both.
Okay,
thanks,
you
Ray.
Take care.
Thanks, Ray.
Hey, Chris, you know, I would like to know what the side effects are of listening to Morning Sedition.
You may experience gas with oily discharge, increased bowel movements, an urgent need to have them, and an inability to control them.
Are you sure that's from our show? That seems a little extreme from a radio show. Who did the research on that? Oily discharge. That's horrendous.
From what?
No, that's horrendous.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That is horrendous. See, I agree with him with like the Viagra thing. Though I've tried it, I believe that maybe it doesn't want to go in there for a reason. You're probably not sick. You know, maybe you should examine. You know. What's going on in your head? You know, what's going on with your relationship, who you are, unless you want to just, be a medicated robot. But I got to admit, it is surprising and fun if you want to try it. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're going to have Temple of Doom coming back, so stay with us.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
In the exciting conclusion to our story, Mark and Grace have discovered that the Antichrist is Jay Leno. Yes, I know. Big surprise. Anyway, Mark said something wrong as usual, and now Jay Leno is bringing about the end times.
So, Mark and Grace, you followed Marilyn Manson to the portal of Hades, or as it's known by its official name, The Tonight Show, and you've guessed my identity. So now you have two choices. You can become part of my covert satanic army and go forth and do my bidding, then go to hell. All right, take your soul right now and down you go.
Hey, what about me?
Eh, I don't think so. Marilyn, everyone in hell says you creep them out.
Wait a minute. Satan has a covert army on Earth?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have thousands of people out there in every area. Politics, law enforcement, internet, even air conditioning repair, ironically enough. You name it. Some you might have guessed already. Dick Cheney, George Bush, Karl Rove, Fred Phelps, Emeril Lagasse, Judge Judy, the actor who played teacher on Saved by the Bell, and that mean guy at your deli, Mark. You know, the one who never puts mustard on your sandwich, no matter how many times you ask him. Always conveniently forgets to give you a pickle.
I thought that guy just hated me.
No, no, he's one of my minions. He's pure evil. So what's it going to be, a lifetime in service to the horned beast, the dark angel? Oh, yeah, ready to take the express to hell, no waiting.
Wait a minute. If you're the Antichrist, I want to see some proof. Transform yourself into something evil, horrible, and hideous right in front of our eyes.
Okay, no problem.
You're on the air with Satan. Dark Lord, ruler of the netherworld, and proud Republican.
Ah! Good enough?
I don't care if you're the Antichrist or not. You don't scare me. I've lived in Hollywood. You're not going to take us without a fight.
Mark, I'm Satan. Yeah, you know, dark forces, evil incarnate. There's nothing you can do. There's only one person who's my match.
Here's Jesus.
Step off, Beezle. Bet she's a friend of mine, unlike you. I always like Letterman more.
Yeah, yeah, that's ancient history, just like you.
Ugh, you don't think I got it anymore?
Bring it, old man.
You are so middle of the road, you should have a line down your back.
Yeah, well, your delivery is worse than the post office in Belize.
I don't want to say you're white bread, but your jokes build strong bodies 12 ways.
Your jokes are so old, your cue cards are in hieroglyphics.
All right, you asked for it. It was so hot today.
How hot was it?
Police in New York were checking people's ice packs.
It was so hot that I got nothing. You win.
Now that we all know you're the Antichrist, Mark and Grace can get the word out. I've got to get back to heaven. I'm meeting Marilyn Monroe for drinks at 7.
Hey, thank her for letting me use half of her name.
So that's it for the Antichrist.
That's right, Grace. We're going to tell the world that Jay Leno is the bringer of evil. Might as well get used to it, Leno. Your reign of deceit has ended. It's over. Finished. You've lost.
Yeah, that's fine. Say, Mark, do you want to do the show sometime?
Sure. September is wide open.
Mark?
This has been Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom. Our bizarre and adventurous story starred Mark Maron and Catherine Sardina, and co-starred in alphabetical order Doug Desher, Jim Earle, Mike Ferrucci, Wayne Gilman, Kent Jones, Barry Lank, Brendan McDonald, Deanna Neal, Dan Pashman, Zach Polakoff, Mark Riley, Carmen Shamwell, Mishna Wolf, and probably 6 or 7 other people we forgot. Our engineers were Brendan McDonald and Doug Desher. I'm Barry Lank, your announcer. Thanks for tuning in, tip your waitress, and stay tuned later for the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company's production of A Streetcar Named Desire, with Mark Riley as Blanche Dubois and Mark Maron as Stanley Kowalski.
These are love letters, yellowing with antiquity, all from one boy. Poems a dead boy wrote. I hurt him the way you would like to hurt me, but you can't. I'm not young and vulnerable anymore, but my young husband was. Everyone has something they won't let others touch because of their intimate nature.
All right, good effort, man. Good effort, Riley. Good.
Stella!
That's coming up later on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
53 past the hour, Mark Maron back with Mark Riley. That was great, man. You really sounded...
That wasn't me, man.
It was
That wasn't me, man.
Riley doing the big acting work.
Telling you, man, that wasn't me. Where's my agent?
Doing the method acting here on Morning Sedition Radio Theater. What, buddy?
Sorry to bother you, but your stalker's on line one.
Uh-oh.
Oh, man, I don't know whether to ignore this guy. All right, put him through.
Guess who, Mark?
Okay. It's my new best friend, Creepy Stalker. What do you want, man?
So, you're doing a live show at CBGB's tomorrow.
Yes. I guess we'll be there.
That depends, Mark. Will there be free coffee, like usual?
Yeah, I think so.
How about muffins? Will they be free, too?
Listen, man, do you spend any money stalking me?
Can you hold on for a second, Mark? There's someone on the other line.
Okay, all right. I can't believe that I'm going to be holding on for my stalker, but yeah, go ahead.
Just a sec, Mark. Hello, Mom?
Mom, no. It's me, Mark.
Hang on, Mark. Hello, Mom?
No, you idiot. What the hell is wrong? It's me. It's Mark.
I'm not done with you, Mark. Hold on. Mom?
Look. All right, look. You know what? Maybe once you stalk me, once you stalk me when you got a little less going on, okay, pal?
Oh, I'll make the time, Mark. I'm definitely going to make the time. You're not going to like it, Mark. Mom? Mom?
I'm hanging up now, buddy. Oh, man. What is up with
stalking
that guy?
Stalking is highly overrated, apparently.
Oh, so he'll be there. That's something to look forward to at CBGB's tomorrow. If you didn't know that, we will be broadcasting live from CBGB's Rock Club in Manhattan tomorrow morning, 6 to 9 a.m. Little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and from the Sopranos is scheduled to appear there, plus comedian Jim Gaffigan, very funny guy. Maybe Richard Hell will come down from the old days. We're going to have some live rock, free coffee. Tons of giveaways. I keep reading that. Live rock music. What? Live rock music.
Live rock.
Live rock music.
Hey.
That's so weird. I used to call my friend Russ Meneve, who's a comic. He makes fun of me because I said, I once said to him, do you like rock and roll? He goes, what are you, 90? Rock and roll? Who the hell calls it rock and roll anymore? And then I think he built a whole bit based on that.
Uh-oh.
See that? See how I help people without even trying? So that's 6 to 9 from that's tomorrow morning at CBGB's, which means we get to sleep in an extra 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I will be at Giggles Comedy Club in Seattle on Saturday night for two shows. Go to GigglesComedyClub.com. For a little information on that, if you want. And if you want to come down, please come down. You know who might be coming down?
Who?
Brian from Everett.
Whoa! I got an inconsistent...
I got an inconsistent mental disposition. I wonder if... he's probably up. We probably just did. Now we're going to hear from him, I'm sure.
Oh,
I have no
yeah.
doubt about that. So when we come... We're gonna take a break in just a couple of minutes, probably even less than that. It seems, Riley, that they are actually... There's some momentum politically in this city to actually racially profile Arab Americans and Arabs in general for searches.
Well, yeah, there are a couple of elected officials, one of whom I think is just seeking publicity.
Okay.
Because it's so stupid. And the thing is, they actually, this one elected official is actually going to introduce a bill in the state legislature here in New York that would allow the police to do that, even though the cops say they have no interest in doing this.
Yeah, to me, this is one of those things, like when I used to do Colin Quinn's show, this is one of these weird, it's not even a conservative thing, it's people who are freaked out and believe that at any cost you should protect the country and that can supersede any civil rights issues whatsoever.
Well, it also is about people wanting publicity for themselves and, you know, getting their pictures in the paper and getting interviews and that sort of thing.
And they say things like protect our way of life. What is our way of life? What is the American way of life? We're going to get into this story in just a couple of minutes. We've also got, we got a great singer coming on later. Dar Williams, if you're a fan, will be here. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Blah, blah, blah.
6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Yo.
I ate 3 donuts. That's ridiculous. 3 donuts? What is that? It wasn't even a special day. I'm not going to sleep, dude. I'm just going to keep them coming.
No, I am.
What is it? Like, is there a record? Like, I can't imagine working in an office where people just bring donuts every day. That must be an office full of fat people.
Well,
am I wrong?
Never mind. Let me not say. You haven't been to Midtown South Precinct.
I see the cops and the donuts. But, man, how can you not just keep eating them? Why can't there be a world in where I can eat everything I want all day long? Donuts. That's all I want is donuts.
Well, maybe there's some kind of a pill that allows you to do that.
Really? That's right, yeah. Maybe I should, where's that pill? Are you hungry all the time?
Gas with oily discharge.
No more pills.
Maybe that'll make you wean you off the donuts, the gas with the oily discharge.
I don't even like donuts that much. I got to be honest with you. They're tasty and they're enjoyable, but you taste them all day. They kind of annoy me. How many did you eat, Chris?
I ate one.
You ate one?
Yes.
What? You want another one? Do you want another one?
No, I do.
Why aren't you going to get? Why? What are you afraid
of? Disciplined, self-motivated.
That guy? Come on. What are you talking? Why don't you eat more donuts, man? You're always wanting to tell me to eat donuts. No, you're not going to eat any? All right,
no,
fine.
I'm not going to eat any more. Right.
But there's cream ones in there. I'm going to bring one in. All right. Hey, folks.
Hey, what? The Guinness Book of World Records
yeah.
it says the most donuts eaten in 6 minutes
is 29.
6 minutes?
Yes.
29 donuts?
29 donuts in 6 minutes.
Oh, I just got a wave of nauseousness.
That's inhalation. That's not eating.
I just got a wave of nauseousness. Can you imagine this to your stomach filling up with donut? Oh, my God. It's disgusting. All right. Let's get into the news. The U.S. State Department has just warned Americans to maintain a high level of vigilance. Quote, a high level of vigilance while living or traveling in Britain following the bombings in London last month. But this is hot off the wire here, right?
Yeah, this is brand new, and it is not going to make the British government happy. Remember, there are partners in the war on terror, but this is exactly Britain's worst nightmare. 3.6 million Americans travel to Britain for vacation every year.
But this is serious stuff that's taken them this long to issue a warning. It makes me a little frightened there, Riley, because it has been a couple of weeks, and now they're issuing the warning. You know, this is a day after they filed the first charges in London in the terror investigations Wednesday. That was yesterday, accusing a 23-year-old man of withholding information about the July 21st transit bombers. So this comes a day after they make the first charges against one of the people involved, in the bombings that killed 56 people. They issue this high vigilance terror warning. It's so reminiscent to me of post 9/11 America.
Yeah, but I mean, did the British issue a similar kind of warning, warning Britons not to come to America after September 11th?
I don't know. It reminds me, like, my thought is that being here with the terror warnings every other day, you know, whether they meant something or they didn't mean something, or whether they were politicized or whether they weren't politicized, the general feeling of living in that state of, like, whether you believe there was a real threat or not, just being warned all the time that there was, you know, high vigilance, whatever that means. Yeah, you know, it means, you know, looking around, being aware of your surroundings, you know, looking at the subways, to the point now where what we're seeing in America now, in New York specifically, is that over the weekend, State Assemblyman Dove Hykind, a Democrat from Brooklyn, said police should be focusing on those who fit the, quote, terrorist profile, end quote. He said, quote, they all look a certain way. It's all very nice to be politically correct here, but we're talking about terrorism, unquote. He wants to profile Arabs on the subway. Now, on Tuesday, City Councilman James Otto, a Republican from Staten Island, said that his emotions relating to the September 11, 2001, World Trade Center attack by Middle Eastern men in hijacked airplanes caused him to publicly declare his support for Hykind's statements. So this is a couple of guys in local politics who says, you know, this is Otto, quote, the reality is that there is a group of people who want to kill us and destroy our way of life. I hate that talking point. I hate that talking point, to destroy our way of life. Doesn't searching Arabs destroy our way of life, democracy? Doesn't that destroy our way of life? Is that the kind of way of life that you want to live under?
See, my thing is very simple. Put Otto and Dove Hykind in front of 20 non-white men.
Yeah.
Pick the Arabs.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Let's see how many they actually get right. Because the fact of the matter is, in a city like New York, where you have 180, count them, 180 different languages spoken, 170-some-odd different ethnicities in this city, in the city alone,
yeah,
you are not going to be able to pick out Arabs from Pakistanis, from Yemen, from all of these different groups of people. Now, remember,
from Brazilians who have their electrical gear that are going to work.
Yeah, I mean, it is what they're talking about. That's why I said earlier, I really think this is just a publicity stunt. Because the fact of the matter is that the minute you start targeting Arabs, they're going to get Pakistanis, quiet as is kept, are not Arabs.
Right. And Hykind is a representative. He's a state assemblyman
from Brooklyn,
from an Orthodox Jewish area.
Yes.
Which adds a whole other element to a sort of, like, you know, racially profiling Arab sort of system there. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. And the other side of it is, of course, it gives people the impression that he's saying, well, target the Arabs, but don't target the Jews. Mm-hmm. That's the impression that he gives. I don't know if that's what he means, but that's the kind of impression. In a city like New York, where, you know, racial issues are just under the surface of everything.
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
Right.
With this.
And Hykind said he's going to introduce legislation allowing police to racially profile. And this guy, Otto, from Staten Island, said he intended to introduce a resolution in the city council supporting the member, the measure. where'd that come from? The New York Police Department said in a statement that racial profiling was, quote, illegal, of doubtful effectiveness, and against department policy, end quote. Mayor Bloomberg reiterated Tuesday that it is against the law and doesn't work. He said, quote, I'm against it for fairness reasons. reasons, and we're not going to do it, end quote. And they probably are doing it anyways, but when they're doing it to everybody, at least you have that, what would you call it? It's masked.
It's masked to some extent, but isn't it interesting, A, that we talked about this when they first started the bag checks here in New York, Mark. We talked about how
could they not?
How could they not racially profile? But the flip side of this is you have a Democrat arguing for racial profiling and a Republican saying, oh, no, we won't. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, a Republican. I mean, some people think he's just a Democrat in sheep's clothing. But a Republican says, no, we are not going to use it for all the right reasons. It doesn't work. It is intrusive. It violates people's civil rights. And you have a Democrat, Democrat, saying, well, we can't be politically correct. They all look alike. Search them.
So if you're an Arab American and you've experienced this, or anybody, in the recent searches here in New York, have you guys been searched or felt profiled in any way? Are there any of you out there that consider themselves progressives that may agree that racial profiling for a period of time is not an unreasonable thing? Or is this, is there anyone out there that has any statements in terms of how this is completely ineffective, that no matter what we do, that policy needs to be changed in order to stifle this in the future, and that any quick fix is not going to be effective because they're going to find another way around it? 866-303-2270 is our number for your input about a state assemblyman, a state assemblyman. Dov Hyken, a Democrat, says he wants to introduce legislation allowing for racial profiling. 866-303-2270. 14 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Eighteen past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. What you hear right now is Dar Williams, and she will be out here momentarily to play some songs for us and chat with us. I'm looking forward to that. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Sounds like she's got a real voice.
She collaborated with a lot of people on this upcoming album, too.
Oh, yeah?
Ani DeFranco, a bunch of people.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we'll ask her about that.
Yeah.
Well, it's something to talk about. Right now, we're talking to you. Over the weekend, State Assemblyman Dov Hyken, the Democrat from Brooklyn, said police should be focusing on people who fit the, quote, terrorist profile. He says that he's got some sort of secret way of identifying Arabs. That's what they said in London when they blew that Brazilian away. Now,
yeah.
Look, you know, this is bad news. He's going to try to introduce legislation. Mike Bloomberg said it's not going to pass. It's against the law. Ray Kelly had discouraging remarks to say. But there is a momentum out there to do this. And as you said, Riley, you think it's a publicity stunt.
Yeah, I think it's a publicity stunt. And it's based in part on an ongoing battle that's going on in Britain, because there are people in Britain, members of parliament in Britain, and even some members of Britain's black community, who say that, yes, the British police and intelligence should be profiling there as well.
Let's talk to somebody up in Rockland County. Mary, how are you? What's on your mind?
Hey, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I think that it doesn't work, and it leads to copycat terrorism, and also if real terrorists know that they're being racially profiled, it's easy enough to pay or find somebody else to fit the profile to do their dirty work.
Thank you very much for your input, Mary. So what Mary basically said, that it doesn't work. If the terrorists catch on to this, they'll pay somebody to do their dirty work for them. That they'll subcontract. They'll find a way around this, is what we said. This is really just a placebo. Even the searches that we were discussing, even if it makes you feel a little safer, its effectiveness and really as a deterrent is almost nothing.
It's negligible, and racial profiling almost never works, no matter how it's applied. I mean, you know, in New Jersey, where racial profiling was a hot issue for the last decade or so, they were doing it on the New Jersey Turnpike. They weren't stopping the drugs that were flowing up and down the East Coast of the United States because they were racially profiling in Jersey. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's the other question, is that if you're going to put a real police movement or attention on this issue, what about all the other issues that are going on? What about robberies? What about drugs? What about this? What about that? You know what I mean? How much attention are we going to direct towards this? How much money it was costing? $2 million a day.
$2 million a day.
In overtime charges, you know, not charges, but in overtime pay for the police when they started, when they first initiated these searches. Hey, what's going on? Let's talk to Rick in Queens, my neighborhood. What's up, Rick?
Hey, Rick.
Hi, how's it going?
All right. Man.
I'm calling. I actually disagree with you guys on this. I had an experience where I was, I guess you can say, racially profiled. I'm not Hispanic. I'm a white Italian American, and I have olive skin, dark olive skin, especially in the summer. I could pass for an Arab or even a Hispanic.
Yeah.
And I was online at an airport, and I actually turned to my wife and I said, "Watch, I'm going to get singled out because I'm tall and I'm dark skinned."
Right.
And turns out that I did get, you know, singled out. And
okay.
They searched me a lot more vigorously than anybody else on the line, you know, except for, like, some other people ahead of me. But, like, I was singled out.
So how are you disagreeing with us?
Well, you know, after the fact, you know, I said, I turned to my wife and I told you, and I said, I told you, you know, I was going to get singled out. And, but I said to myself, you know, I said actually to my wife, I said, you know, I really don't care because, I mean, if it makes it more effective and if it makes it more difficult for terrorists to get through, I'll accept the inconvenience.
But wait a minute, Ray. See, now here's the key point that you just brought up. If it makes it more difficult for terrorists, how do you know that one of the people they didn't profile as or check as closely as you on that line wasn't carrying something? They know you weren't. How do you know no one else was?
Well, see, your previous caller, Mary, she made a point. She said, If they start profiling, terrorists are going to have to go out and recruit lighter-skinned people. Now, in the Middle East, you don't have a lot of light-skinned people, so that right there.
You ever been to Iran, Ray?
No, no.
They're not even Arabs.
I've been to Turkey.
They are not even Arabs.
Yeah.
The issue, I think what you're talking about is that, Rick, is that the issue is that I've had that same feeling that you have, but that's just because it placates your personal fear and you think that what they're doing works and you think that, you know, that you're not inconvenienced by it because you think it works to some greater good. From every indication, it doesn't really work towards any greater good, and they've just let us surrender to fear and allow them to do anything. I think it's a mindset that comes from fear, and we've all been sold that bill of goods, but I appreciate your call. Thanks,
all
Rick.
Right, thanks for calling.
You know, I mean, it's like that, but he's basically saying he wasn't really disagreeing with us. He was, you know, sold the bill of goods that says, look, you know, I'll go through this if it helps.
Yeah, if it helps.
And what we're saying is there is no real indication that it helps. And certainly, you know, on airplanes, there's a million different ways things are supposed to be doing. There really shouldn't be, you shouldn't have to search anyone any more than anybody else because they should have the security in place to stop bombs and weapons coming through.
Or... And it would be a nightmare, but why I would advocate for profiling everybody. Profile each and every crime that people commit and profile exactly who commits them and then go after that particular group of people. If it turns out that most car thieves are Asian, then go after the Asians. If it turns out most people that commit grand larceny are white, then go after white people. Go profile everything and every crime if you want to do it that way. Let's see what happens.
Wow, that's an interesting idea, Riley. My brain's exploding. Aiden in New Jersey, what's going on? What's on your mind?
Hey.
I just wanted to say about Dove Hikind in Brooklyn, what I don't understand is the fact that a lot of the Jewish community in Brooklyn, it's the biggest center of Syrian Jews, many of whom many of whom look exactly like Arabs. So what he's talking about makes virtually no sense just for his own community.
Thank you for your call. Dove Hikind, a Democrat from Brooklyn, is the state assemblyman there.
Yeah, he's an assemblyman, but see, what you have to understand about what Dove Hikind is doing is trying to make sure that they don't go into his community for that kind of profiling.
Let's take one more call from Jimmy. How are you, Jimmy, in Asheville, North Carolina?
Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, guys. It's a pleasure to talk to y'all.
All right. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind, bro?
I had 2 points. First of all, this talk always just makes me sigh in exasperation. Timothy McVeigh and Eric Rudolph were not Arabs.
Mm-hmm. No.
And people always tend to forget our recent history. And furthermore, it just seems like a continuation of the conservative movement to have a boogeyman to hate.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely. It's set up on in policy and on all levels. The whole war on terror is the reinvention of the Cold War altogether.
Yeah, sure is.
Thanks a lot for your call. It did only sound like someone clapped in the background, didn't it? When like Jimmy was in his car down there in North Carolina, and he said that. I thought I heard someone do
someone
this.
Someone clapping in the background?
Yeah, yeah. Good for you, Jimmy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, man, Asheville, North Carolina is a red part of a red state, so. Hey.
I haven't been in North Carolina in a long time. I actually have to get down south and maybe do a little comedy down there.
You're taking your life in your hands doing comedy in the South.
You think
man.
So? I was in Louisville once, but just once.
Just once. And you were in Cincinnati, which isn't considered the South by most, but it's awful close to Kentucky.
We had a few good liberal folks, a few Democrats out in Cincinnati came out, some new listeners. We've been on the air about a week. Apparently, in that part where I was at, though they're surrounded by Republicans, that was a pretty Democratic area. That sound you hear is Dara Williams, and she will be with us momentarily to sing and talk. I hope you stick around for that. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. In a little while, we're gonna have Bruce Cherry come out here and pitch a comedy idea.
Uh-oh,
it's gonna be interesting. But right now, she's been described as someone who engages in folk singing. That's an interesting way to put it. Rolling Stone magazine describes her as feminine and foul-mouthed. Wow, this is gonna be exciting. She's a politically minded singer-songwriter with great pipes to boot. Her latest CD, My Better Self, comes out next month. Dar Williams joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Dar.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow, that's feminine and foul-mouthed. What is that referring to?
Well, I remember an interviewer once said, you know, I said something really, you know, foul-mouthed. I said, well, don't put that in the interview. And she said, well, okay, wait a minute. You know, your whole thing is honesty, but you swear like a sailor. You're not a vegetarian, and you don't want anyone to know that. You know, you're straight, and nobody knows that. And she said, where does the honesty begin? And so I said, okay, fine, you can do it verbatim. And I was telling the Rolling Stone guy about that. And I am, I guess, pretty foul-mouthed.
You're foul-mouthed, you're not a vegetarian, and you're straight.
Yeah, these were some
I guess
surprises.
I lost the bet, Riley.
Yeah,
sorry.
I guess so. Here, pay up, man.
But one time I swore in front of an audience, and this very kind of hippie-ish person in the front row just shook her head like, no, man, that's not going to happen. You're not going to be a person who swears on stage. So I don't. I'm actually really careful.
That resonated with you? The hippie up front said, you're really harsh in my buzz.
Yeah, yeah. It was like 1994. Yeah. I was just starting. I was playing in a guitar shop in Boise, and it was the first time, and I said something. And it felt a little funny, but I thought, you know, well, you know, you always go, oh, Lenny Bruce.
Yeah,
you know?
Go for it. Push the envelope.
Yeah, right. And she had this, she looked very sort of progressive and cool, and she just shook her head like, that's not going to happen in your career.
Yeah, are you? She didn't actually say that. You just assumed that's what it meant.
Oh, that's a good point.
Read it that way. That was the voice.
Yeah, and I absolutely believed what I read.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, that's all right. So is this the new album? It's called My Better Self. Is this more personal or more political than usual? I don't know how. Which way is that? My Better Self.
You know, it's probably both. Uh-huh. I think somebody pointed out, you know, that it's not really a pretentious title when you're a mother. You know, I have a one-year-old, mm-hmm. and, you know, you just don't have time to polish your image.
Okay.
And so I really just assume that your better self is what comes out when you're not trying so hard.
And also when you have a kid, I'd imagine you would think that your better self would come out. Not my mother,
yeah.
But I mean, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I hope that's the case.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Do you want to do a song from this record?
Sure. I'll do one could argue that this is one of the political songs.
Okay.
This is called Empire.
Great.
Who's afraid of the sun? Who would question the goodness of the mighty? We who banish the threat. When your little ones all go nighty-nighty, well, there's no time for doubt right now and less time to explain. So get back on your horses, kiss my ring, join our next campaign, and the empire grows with the news that we're winning, with more fear to conquer and more gold thread for spinning, bright as the sun, shining on everyone. Some would say that we forced our words, and we find that ingenuously churlish words are just words. Don't be so pessimistic, weak and girlish. We like strong, happy people who don't think there's something wrong with pride. Work makes them free, and we spread that freedom far and wide. And the empire grows the seeds of its glory for every five tanks. Plant a sentimental story till they worship the sun, even Christ-loving ones. And we'll kill the terrorizers and a million of the racists. But when our people torture you, that's a few random cases. Don't question the sun, it doesn't help anyone. But the journalists cried out when it was too late to stop us. Everyone had awakened to the dream they could enter our colossus. Now I'm right, yeah, you said I'm right. There's nothing that can harm me, 'cause the sun never sets on my dungeons or my army. And the empire fell on its own splintered axis, and the emperor wanes as the silver moon waxes, and the farmers will find old coins in their strawberry fields, while somebody somewhere twists his ring, someone kneels. Oh, where is the sun shining for everyone? Oh, where is the sun shining for everyone?
Dar Williams,
nice.
That's the song
nice.
Empire. What a beautiful, powerful song. What inspired that? Was there a singular event?
No, there was no singular event.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was, you know, it's probably passing by the History Channel or something when you suddenly recognize your present era. When you're watching something and you realize that, I mean, I think I had one thought, and that was the beginning of the song, which is that if you're really dedicated to expanding you, the price you pay is your own civilization.
Mm-hmm.
That's the coffers you have to raid, and you know, that's what I saw in other civilizations, and I just went back in history and didn't really need to comment on any present time.
Mm-hmm. Great song.
Now you write a lot of your work comes from personal experience, obviously. And I wonder if there is a routine that you go through when you write, as opposed to perhaps composing the music, the lyrics. Is there a place that you go? Is there a situation that you're most comfortable in when you do that?
No, not necessarily. It's kind of, it's more like I have to undo myself somehow, you know. And it's kind of a, you know, sound of the one hand clapping thing where you have to listen for the impossible. And then when you stop pressuring yourself to hear something kind of pops into your head. And the first line came in when I was in Dublin, and I was saying, I really have to write some new songs. I really, and I just kind of let it go. And then, the big secret probably of my whole career is just to pay attention when this little subtle thing slips into my head, hopefully with words, but a little thing of melody.
Mm.
And then I just kind of build around it. So it's kind of, you have to pay attention to your most subtle self.
And then that's when you say to whoever you're with, pen. I need a pen. Does anyone have a pen? Is there a napkin? Give me that napkin and a pen.
Pass that over here.
You know, it's really nice to travel with other singer-songwriters because, you know, they... I traveled with a bunch of women, and we all brought our guitars into our hotel rooms. None of us touched our guitars. We all watched TV. We all and then there is that thing, you know, the pen, or walking off into another room or something. If you don't take it seriously, then you'll lose something. So you have to be that kind of person.
Sure. Well, also, you know, you have to honor the spontaneity of it. A lot of my writing is done on napkins and on pieces of paper, and then I can't read it. And that's half the fun for me is trying to figure out what the hell I wrote. And then usually it's unimpressive, and I throw it away. But it's a process. So do you want to play another song, Dar?
Sure, sure. I was trying to think what I would play today. So... I was thinking my husband's listening to this right now. He's streaming at home. He's doing paperwork instead of going to work.
Hi, Dar's husband.
Yeah. So this is something I wrote for Michael.
Aww.
We could pretend that we're walking on petals at night, golden light, flaunting our love like a dance step mastered, turning from left to right. But after all the colored lights are gone, time will leave the ashes and the dawn. You rise and meet the day, and watching you go is like spying on hope ever onward with more to burn. Giving your hands and to the wheel of the world, though it fights each turn. But you do not give up so easily. It's how I know you won't surrender me. You rise and meet the day. It's all I need, it's all I need to know. It's all I need to know. I love you all the time. I had always feared that some gloomy ingratitude would seize me, but you have held the dream like every morning finds a way to hang the sun up in the sky. Now I think I have it too. The greatest part I learned from you. You rise and me day, and I can see kids, maybe yours, maybe not. Oh, oh, I can hear what they'll say, laughing at pictures with the old-fashioned hats and the clothes that we're wearing today. And they will know the true and humble power, love that made it through the darkest hour. You rise and meet the day. It's all I need, it's all I need to know. It's all I need to know.
It's great. Great.
Very nice.
Dar Williams, that's beautiful. The new CD, My Better Self, comes out next month. If you want some info on tour dates and on, I imagine, on Dar Williams herself, you can go to darwilliams.com. That was a sweet song. I really appreciate you coming down.
Yeah.
It was great hearing you, great talking to you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Don't be a stranger. Come back.
Yeah, really, okay. Do come back. It's 46 past the hour. Sweaty Bruce Cherry is going to come in here and try and pitch some comedy in a second, so stay tuned for that.
Morning's Edition, on the air. MorningsEdition.com, Air America Radio.
50 past the hour. We're going to put this thing down. It's Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
You'll see us tomorrow morning at CBGB's Rock Club, man, at the corner of Bowery and Bleecker. Little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band and the Sopranos. Comedian Jim Gaffigan. Richard Hell might stop by. I'm not sure yet. Yeah, there's going to be some music. That's right, Bruce. Richard Hell.
Uh-oh.
There's going to be music, free coffee. That's going to be tomorrow. I'll be at Giggles on Saturday in Seattle. That's gigglescomedyclub.com for ticket info on that if you live in Seattle. And as you know, our writers come on to the show to perform as some of our regular characters. All of our writers have at least one character they come on the show to do. All of our writers except for Bruce Cherry, who, while very funny,
canard.
That's a canard.
Very funny, has yet to come up with a character that can become a regular on Morning's Edition. This bothers Bruce a little bit, and it makes him a little paranoid. So in interest of making Bruce feel more comfortable, every week Bruce will come on the show to pitch live to us a character piece that just might make it into the regular rotation. We have to like it, of course, and we'd appreciate audience feedback on some of his characters. And so now... by the way, before I set this up, Bruce, NBC is looking for pitches, too, so if this doesn't work out here, they're in desperate need of a television pilot. Here we have Bruce Cherry for Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week.
There are no pirates in primetime. and I would mention that I believe there was quite a bit of positive.
The credulous part, yes, yeah. I can see that on NBC. So you save that for them. What do you got for us this week?
Okay, yeah. Back to the drawing board, right?
Okay.
Our target is the Bush administration.
Okay, I think that's reasonable. That fits in.
Down to basics. Mm-hmm. And I figured let's spear him from the inside, get like a deep throat, somebody that calls in. I would play that individual.
A mole or a guy in the inside.
Yeah. So, but this is the person who's responsible for all their planning, like really, really inside, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, we got problems. Right away, right?
Okay.
Why would this? It can't be like a Karl Rove.
Why?
I mean, why would they talk to us, right?
Yeah.
Problem number one.
Okay.
Okay. And then this is where the synergy, where everything kind of comes together.
Yeah.
Second point.
Yeah.
You want to make it a person who, by their very essence, lampoons the incompetence of the administration.
Right. Yeah.
And C, throw in a pop culture reference and you're mining gold.
Okay.
Ooh.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Here. Okay. So who is our deep throat?
Yeah.
Remember that show, Life Goes On?
Yeah, I'll say I do. No, which one was that?
There was a kid named Corky on it.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right.
There we go.
The retarded kid.
He calls in.
Yeah.
I can play him. Well, yeah, okay. We try to avoid the term, which you just said. Okay?
Mentally challenged. I apologize. I have a problem with that.
Developmentally problems, okay?
So you're going to be you're going to call in as a retarded kid.
Again, you know, the
mentally challenged kid. I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry.
Phrasing is, you know, you're walking a delicate line here.
Do you
want
to give us a...
Some people are going to... you know what? If it's
no, people get very mad at me for that.
Yeah.
I apologize.
If we're not going to, like...
All right. No, let's take it seriously. All right. So let's take it seriously. I'm sorry. So a mentally challenged comedic character, but you're not making fun of...
Absolutely not, and that is the point that has to be, like, really, or else people think it's politically incorrect.
Yeah, how does this work? Can you give us a taste?
I call it deep Corky or Corky throat. that's the problem, because neither one really scans, you know, and they bring up images that are probably uncomfortable.
So this is like Corky throat?
Throat.
Corky throat probably is, like I said, problematic. The name is not important at this point. The point is that we have... A retarded person that we're not making fun of. It's a political satire.
It's mentally challenged.
Yeah,
right?
Okay.
Yeah. Not anymore.
You know what? I think of you because you have points to make and you have beliefs. It's like it'll be a bully pulpit.
Bully pulpit.
Yeah, for you. You can make your points because you have a back and forth with me as Corky. And the fact is, you know, the guy, me, he's... But my debating problems or my debating skills are suspect.
So wait, are you setting me up here for me? I'm going to sit and argue with a retarded Republican?
Absolutely, and that way chances are you'll win. Okay, the only...
He calls me a Tom, now he insults you.
That was off the air. Okay.
Next week he'll do it.
The only retort that the individual had me as is thud up, Mark. Okay? That's what... No, that's what I think. I'm thinking, like, T-shirts. You want a catchphrase, something that's going to, like, brand the show, brand the piece. You can have your
Wake up sheeple isn't good enough, huh?
Dud up, Mark?
Can you imagine walking down the street? Yeah, I mean, you're doing your giggles in Seattle, and people in the audience, dud up, Mark, and it just, like, suddenly you're...
Bruce, we're not going to call in as Corky the retarded Republican with a catchphrase of dud up, Mark. It's not going to happen.
Dud up,
Then I'm not even a bother with Defense Minister Jerry Jewell.
What is that?
Okay. Way too obscure. Okay. James Brady sings.
No. That's it.
Okay.
All right, you know, we'll try this again next week, Bruce. Why don't you call NBC, okay? For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. Some elected officials in New York are calling on police to target Arabs during security checks. Civil libertarians point out that racial profiling during subway checks is racist, and they say it won't work since most Arabs are driving cabs anyways. What's happened? In response, the New York Police Department said racial profiling is, quote, illegal, of doubtful effectiveness, and against department policies, adding, but hey, it sure is easier. All right. President Bush allegedly objects to the war on terror being renamed the Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism, or GSAVE. Bush objects to the new acronym because he hates any language that's accurate and descriptive. A pioneering South Korean scientist has cloned the first dog. Scientists are hopeful that the new cloning technique will go a long way toward alleviating the worldwide shortage of dogs.
Ooh.
One Korean scientist said, wait, I'm not done with the racist one. One Korean scientist said the only drawback with the clone dogs is they have these slight chemical taste.
No.
Was that one of yours?
No.
All right.
Shut up, Mark. You're making fun of Korean.
Today's phrase, just dropping into conversation, it's not war on terror anymore. It's a global struggle against violent extremists. Yeah, that's what'll break the back of the jihadists. Semantic changes. Wake up, sheeple. The bombs don't speak English.
CBGB's, baby.
Tomorrow morning, 6 to 9, we got little Steven Van Zandt, Jim Gaffigan, and what do you have to say to that?
Shut up, Mark!
Good show, Riley.
Good show, Air America Radio!
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.